You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Justin Wong toku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te wā mō tēnei rā, te rā te kaumawhitu o Pōtu Te Rangi. Kia ora and welcome to the Tuesday Wire for Rātū Tuesday the 17th of March. My name is Justin and I will be with you for the next hour. And joining me in studio, I have not only one, but two producers. I am joined in studio by Bronnie Wild and making her Wire debut, Hannah Thompson. How are you both?
Nervous but excited.
That reminds me so much of my first Wire. And does that remind you of your first Wire too, Bronnie?
I don't actually think I can even remember my first Wire.
How so? Why?
It's not that it was that long ago, but I think maybe I just blocked it out. Too traumatizing.
Anyway, let's get into it. FIQA coming up on the show today. International Desk will be reviewing on the coronavirus situation in Europe. Rachel McIntosh from Etu Union talks to me about the current situation in New Zealand. Hannah speaks to Ben Rosmond, a union organizer, researcher, and community activist with Organise Aotearoa about the social dimensions of the COVID-19 outbreak.
And on the Green Desk, I spoke to Phil Jones from Sustainable Business Network about their Gulf X project to restore the Māori of the Hauraki Gulf.
As always, he aha o whakaro, get in touch with any thoughts you have. Tuka pai to he mai, you can text us by 5395 or call us in studio, or wire mai rane, call us in studio on 309-3879. I tēnei watanu, let's get into it.
Kia tau te rangi mari e. Tuanuku e takatone, o te tai ao e awhine I a tātou, tihei Māori ora. This is The Green Desk on 95BFM.
Today on The Green Desk, I chatted with Phil Jones from the Sustainable Business Network about their Gulf X project, which aims to restore the Māori of the Hauraki Gulf, or as it is otherwise known, Tikapa Moana. The sixth State of Our Gulf report, which was recently published, highlighted the urgency with which we need to act. Some of the more shocking statistics of the report included the occurrence of 10 mass mortality events of fish and shellfish in the Gulf in the past 10 years and 9 toxic algal blooms. This is due in part to the fact that almost 4,000 tonnes of nitrogen flows into the Firth of Thames from the rivers in Hauraki every year. Crayfish are also functionally extinct in the Gulf after once being one of its most abundant species. While the report identified overfishing as another serious cause of biodiversity loss, the Gulf X project chose to focus on the terrestrial sources of environmental degradation, such as sediment, plastic, and heavy metals. Phil began by telling me what we mean when we talk about the Hauraki Gulf.
The Hauraki Gulf is obviously one of our taongas. It's the playground for most Aucklanders over the summer and at other times. So it's a really special place. So in 2000, a Parliament Act was passed, basically creating the Hauraki Gulf Marine Park. And the intention behind that was to basically improve the management of the Gulf because there were clear signs of emerging problems in terms of its health.
Can I ask just about that term marine park? How does that differ to a marine reserve?
Good question. It doesn't mean that it's protected, and this is one of the key challenges, really, and the issues we have, because actually only about 0.3% of the marine park area, which is actually New Zealand's largest national park, it's the only marine park, national park, all the others are on land, but it is actually the largest by area. So it stretches sort of Mongafai up in the north all the way down to close to Waihi, down the east coast. So that's a huge area in terms of the size, but also the catchment, the sort of land-based catchment that then feeds into that area is also very large. So it's not just the sort of eastern fringe of Auckland and up the east coast towards Northland. It actually covers a lot of the Waikato area as well. So the catchment includes, it's sort of a finger all the way down to Rotorua. So basically, a raindrop that falls just north of Rotorua will discharge into a stream, into one of the Hauraki Plain rivers, and be discharged into the Firth of Thames. So it's a massive area.
And how does that kind of interconnectedness affect the way that you've approached this with the management?
Well, so we are SBN, Sustainable Business Network. We are a member-based network, but essentially our purpose is to empower business so that people and nature prosper. So it's really changing how we do business. That's what we're about. And obviously we have a whole range of different sort of focus areas, climate action, what we call the circular economy, but also clean water is a big focus. So that is where we've got involved in some of the work around, you know, protecting and restoring the Hauraki Gulf.
And I believe the name of this project is Gulf X.
Yes, so we received funding from the Foundation North Gift Fund to devote to the restoration of the Māori of the Hauraki Gulf. It's basically improving the health of the Hauraki Gulf.
And talking about the Māori of the Hauraki Gulf, I understand that it is somewhat lacking at the moment. Could you describe that?
Sure. Last week, the latest State of Our Gulf report was published by the Hauraki Gulf Forum, and that's the sixth report that's been published since the year 2000. And progressively over that time, each of these reports has described a slow or not so slow deterioration in the health of the Gulf in different ways. So this latest report is pretty alarming, and you know, some of the commentary that's included in the report is really raising a warning flag to Auckland and the nation, really, that we've got to up our game on this because we're not looking after it as we need to and things are deteriorating. You know, it's quite easy to assume that because on a bright sunny summer's day, the water looks beautiful, it's sparkling, and it kind of hides the reality of below the surface in terms of, you know, the degradation of fish stocks, the impacts of sediment, and generally problems in terms of pollution.
How does Gulf X tie in with the Sustainable Business Network's other projects?
Sure. So with our Gulf project, we're very much focused on land-based pollution sources. So there's obviously what happens actually out on the water. You know, overfishing is clearly a really problem area. You know, for example, the snapper and tarakia are below 20% of their unfished biomass levels, so lots of significant issues there. In terms of what we're doing, so as I say, we're focusing on land-based pollution sources. So we're particularly looking at the problems of sediment, plastic, and heavy metals or toxic metals. So the sediment is really any ground that's disturbed where there's soil that is exposed to rain potentially contributes to the sediment problem. So over, you know, 50 years, the sediment levels in our harbours has increased significantly. And that basically smothers a lot of the marine life that live at the bottom of the harbour and in a gulf. One thing we're particularly doing with SBN is encouraging tree planting of riparian streamside and riverside banks, which helps to basically trap that sediment.
I was interested by the heavy metal side of thing. I feel like that's not an issue that I've ever really heard about in terms of our marine environments.
Absolutely. It's something that until we started looking into this, we weren't aware of it either, and it comes as quite a surprise. I mean, there are two main toxic metals that are a problem, zinc and copper. And there are various sources for each of those. For copper, the copper brake pads on road vehicles is one source. So basically, as you brake in your vehicle, little fragments get eroded away over time, get into the rainwater, into our drains, and then out into our streams and out to the sea. So elevated levels, that is a problem for small marine organisms. Zinc, again, with motor vehicles, zinc is part of tyres. It's an essential component of the tyre manufacture. So again, as tyres degrade, zinc particles get eroded away and out into the stormwater. So that's a couple of examples. There are others, like we use anti-foul paint, which contains copper, to stop build-up of marine life on boat bottoms. So there's a few issues.
And so how are you tackling that as the Sustainable Business Network?
Sure. Unfortunately, there's not a solution to the zinc in tyres at the moment, but there is a solution to the copper in brake pads. So there are now low or no copper brake pads that are available. So they are actually available in, you know, places like Repco and some of those automotive retail shops. So what we're trying to do is raise the awareness of that, so people at least know that that is an option. And making that small change, you know, does prevent further problems.
And another one I noticed you talking about is plastics. And what I thought was really interesting is that it isn't just focusing on the end of life. It's not just cleaning up our beaches. It's looking earlier on in the life cycles to try and prevent those plastics getting there.
Absolutely. This is a key part of what we've been doing in the last year or so, is really addressing the systemic problems with the plastic packaging system as we've got it. Obviously, we use an awful lot of plastic. It has an important role to play, but we've basically overused it and we're not managing it well. So our plastic packaging project and program has really looked to look at alternatives and very much tied into what we call the circular economy. So that's finding ways of reusing materials or recycling properly and all that sort of thing. So we've been running workshops, masterclasses as we call them, with businesses involved in that sector to basically look to co-develop solutions, and where those solutions already exist, to kind of accelerate their uptake and introduction.
Historically, there's a bit of a pushback against sustainability and environmental practices, sometimes people believing that they are at odds with making a profit, which is the goal of a lot of businesses. So how you kind of approach that and reconcile those differences?
Yeah, that's definitely been historically, that's been the thought, that business is separate from the environment. But I think over time, you know, more and more business leaders have recognized that they actually do have a responsibility to make sure that their operations are sustainable and that they're contributing to a more sustainable society as well. So I think the awareness is now raised. The challenge now is the actual how. How do we make the changes so that businesses can still thrive but without putting those pressures and stresses on the environment? Climate's a really good example of that in terms of climate action. You know, businesses are recognising they've got a role to play in this, and they are at least setting some good targets, which then will encourage meaningful action. And again, climate is a connection to the condition of the health of the Gulf. For example, one of the researchers from Auckland University, Associate Professor Rochelle Constantine, talked about the impact of warming seas in terms of the distribution of microscopic animals within the sea. And they've basically moved away from the coast because the coastal waters have got warmer, which then means that some of the larger things like dolphins and whales tend to move further out as well, because they feed on these microscopic animals. So climate change is also connected very much with the health of the Hauraki Gulf.
Because I understand there have been some successes recently in terms of those larger mammals in the Gulf to do with whale strikes and lowering boat speeds.
Yeah, I think that the report identifies where there have been successes, and that is clearly one. So there has been an improvement, and that shows the power of good voluntary action. I think the question is, you know, voluntary action is good, but we do need some tougher regulation and enforcement of regulation, and that goes back to making more of the marine park properly protected, you know, in terms of marine reserves. Some people are advocating for up to 30% of the Hauraki Gulf Marine Park area to be protected reserves by 2030, say. The Hauraki Gulf Forum have a 10% target without a specified date. So, you know, there is some advocacy for that, but it is urgently needed, I think, because voluntary actions won't do it, basically.
And on that same topic, I know some people are advocating around the idea of a legal personhood status for the Gulf, same as we have with the Whanganui River.
I think that would be a really positive move. I think generally we've got to recognise that we are part of nature, we're not separated from nature. So that's a sign that we're properly reflecting that in the way we manage these special places.
Obviously there is a bit of a time pressure now more than ever to restore the Māori of the Gulf. I understand you have some sort of goals in mind at the end of this 3-year project.
I mean, there are two major events obviously happening in Auckland next year, 2021, America's Cup in March and the APEC meeting in September. So the eyes of the world will be on Auckland, and clearly, you know, it won't be a good look for Auckland and New Zealand if we have big heavy rainfall events around the time of the America's Cup, which leads to sediment flows that then appear as brown splurges when the helicopters look down during race time.
And so this event that's happening on the 26th of March, what's that all about?
So we have what we're calling a birthday party for the Gulf. So the Gulf's just turned 20 years, or the marine parks turned 20 years. We're basically going to be showcasing the ways that people can easily take action to contribute to improving the health of the Gulf. And that's from things like how you can get involved in tree planting events or donate to tree planting initiatives. I talked about some of the solutions to, you know, the plastic packaging issues, so we've got some examples of those. And we hope to have some of the solutions to the transport issues as well. We've got some wonderful virtual reality headsets that people can wear and be, you know, underwater looking 360, seeing both the wonderful things and some of the, you know, less wonderful things that are below us, below the surface. We've got heaps of wonderful prizes. We're going to encourage people who come along just to pop in, learn a bit about what the problems and solutions are, and tell us what they'll be doing. What is their commitment? What is their gift to the Gulf for 2020?
That was Phil Jones from Sustainable Business Network talking about the Gift to Our Gulf birthday party. Pop along next Thursday between 11 and 3 at Takutai Square in Britomart to pledge your gift to the Gulf and be in to win some of those prizes he was talking about, which include whale and dolphin safaris and e-bike hire.
That was the Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihe Modi Ora.
Ko te waia tene marunga irirangi poho. That was Green Desk, which Bronnie Wild talks to Phil Jones about the Hauraki Gulf. The time it has just passed 20 minutes past noon, and we will going for a quick ad break. You're on the BFM with Justin.
Heyo, what's in that soup? It looks like a mix of ingredients that, while delicious individually, are even better together.
Ha! That's not soup. It's the Student Radio Network!
Only the freshest ingredients go into the SRN Top 10. Te Te Kau o Rongorereke o Aotearoa gathers up the highest quality, locally grown tracks from New Zealand's student radio stations and brings them together in a fragrant, flavourful and distinctly piquant mix. A chart show for those who prefer to order off menu. Tuesday after 6 on 95 BFM Drive or online at srn.nz. Brought to you by the Student Radio Network.
I'm disappointed by the government these days. Sometimes they just need a good kick in the backside.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. And now for her debut, Hannah.
Hello. I spoke to Ben Rosmond, a union organiser, researcher and community activist with Organise Aotearoa, who wrote an article on solidarity in the time of coronavirus. We spoke about the need for a strong collective response to the pandemic through community organising and a government response that strengthens public institutions like healthcare and welfare and that takes care of our most vulnerable. I began by asking him what his article was about.
A couple of days ago, I published an article called Solidarity in the Time of Coronavirus. And the idea behind this was really to map out a way of getting through this that ensures that human solidarity and communities stay strong through what is a time of isolation and social distancing. So I think that there's a possibility that social distancing becoming the new normal, as Jacinda said last night, could have serious effects, not just through the course of the pandemic, but in the future as well. And I'm really keen to try and make sure as much as possible that community groups and societies and organisations do as much as they can to support people during the outbreak, not just because it'll lead to better outcomes for everyone, but because it'll lead to the survival of those organisations in the future.
We don't have a timeline for when we can expect this all to be over, right? Like, we can kind of expect this to go on indefinitely until we have an idea of when it's actually starting to slow down. So I guess it would be good to actually preserve our connections within our communities, especially in a time when people are a bit scared.
Absolutely, yeah. And so we're already seeing, I don't know if you've seen, but Facebook groups popping up around the country from communities of people wanting to help out other people. I think this is an awesome sign, but we're really just at the start of this, I think, and we're going to be in it for the long haul, and so we've got to make sure that those sorts of responses can scale up and are sustainable and can continue over the course of who knows how long.
Yeah, and I guess you kind of highlighted in your article that a pandemic is different from other, like, similarly destructive events like natural disasters, because it's actually our sociality that is both a, you know, it's kind of viewed as a threat, but it's also how we're going to persevere through this.
Yeah, exactly. And I do want to make it clear that, you know, I think that we should be following the advice of social distancing and self-isolation if you're in, if you are at risk or you've been in contact with people who are at risk. But But it's a huge challenge, right, for people, because, as you say, our social connections and our community connections are what's going to get us through this. So, there's a lot to think about, and I think that a lot of organisations and individuals will be doing a lot of thinking about the best way to respond to it as it goes on.
You said in your article that this has sort of created this culture of overly cautious individualism, and you see that through things like people panic buying, people refusing to leave their homes at all. And I was just wondering how much of this logic is kind of innate to us as people and how much of it is cultural conditioning.
I think that lots of it is specific to the logic of a pandemic. We are the vector of spreading the virus, whereas if we look at responses, community responses, and also government responses to other sorts of disasters, they're all about bringing people together and people getting together and doing things together, fixing, rebuilding, eating, that sort of thing, right? And so I think that there is an innate human response to come together in a time of crisis, and the Facebook groups that I mentioned before of people wanting to do that are a good sign of that. And I know that in countries that have been worse affected than us, we've seen, for example, in Italy, the videos of people singing on their balconies and sort of having some form of social contact, even though they can't be close to each other. And I think those are the things that need to be fostered rather than sort of cut down on during this time.
Yeah, definitely. The sort of distrust of others that we have and viewing other people as like overt threats isn't actually helpful.
No, it's not. There's a couple of things there, because actually it seems like a rational response, right, to want to isolate yourself. And in some situations it isn't a rational response when if you are sick or you've got the virus, because we want to stop the spread of the virus.
But hoarding toilet paper is
not the answer, no.
Yeah.
No. I mean, I think that one possibility is that people are sceptical of the ability for the government to respond to this and to make sure that everyone does have what they need. That possibly goes some way to explaining the panic buying.
I guess it's kind of symptomatic of, like, in New Zealand, there's kind of this attitude that people have of, just like, fuck you, I got mine. You know?
Yeah, sure. I can see that. You know, I think that some of the darkest sides of our society will come out throughout this process, as well as some of the best things about human nature, right? I mean, to me, I think that human nature is, I don't know what I think about human nature, but I think that people, there is an innate drive for collectivity and an innate drive for people to come together in times of crisis. But there's also a drive for self-preservation, right? And so I think that the thing that we've got to be doing, and the government has a role to play in this, and community organisations have a role to play in this, is making sure that people see that self-preservation is actually intimately interlinked with community organisation and with sticking together and getting through this as a collective.
If there is any truth to human nature, I guess it is that we are social creatures at heart.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess this also just kind of shows that, like, looking out for only yourself, it hits a limit, right? Like, you know, with most disasters, you can see that, like, wealth insulates people from the worst effects of it. But here we've got Peter Dutton getting testing positive, Justin Trudeau's wife, Tom Hanks, right?
Yeah.
It's you know, just we're seeing the failings of an individualist approach in the face of what is a public health crisis.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that, I guess, what we see, and this is common to all disasters as well, but they reveal the underlying sort of crises in societies, right? And so what we're seeing now here, I think, is that our healthcare system, our housing, our benefit system, our entire economic system isn't actually fit for purpose. And that's been revealed and exacerbated by these conditions.
Definitely.
So the solutions that that the government is going to be offering in this package, I think, shouldn't just be short-term solutions, but should be focused on long-term structural changes so that we're better prepared in the future, not just through this pandemic.
Yeah, I want to focus a bit on that later, but now I just want to focus on healthcare. This makes it clear just how important public services like these are. And so much of New Zealand's response right now is focused on containment because our health system does not have the capacity to handle an outbreak.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you might remember last year and the year before, even through this year actually, there's been stories constantly in the media about how DHBs are underfunded, how there's not enough beds, there's not enough staff.
Yeah, just like over the winter because of flu season, we're seeing hospitals at capacity already. So
exactly, yeah, and that's going to coincide this year, of course, with the coronavirus flu season. So I think that, you know, we need to be looking at long-term infrastructure investments. We need to be looking at encouraging people to work in healthcare, and that comes in many forms, but one of them is making sure that especially nurses and healthcare assistants are paid livable wages, and it's an attractive profession to go into. Mm. And yeah, I mean, we need to, you know, stop this austerity sort of mindset that's been around for however many years now, and actually think about investing in public infrastructure.
And I guess these are all issues that nurses and doctors have been speaking about for years. You know,
absolutely.
Like they...
And I think one of the other things that that's really important throughout this crisis is that unions and advocacy organisations need to be at the centre of providing the solutions, right? So the nurses' unions, the doctors' unions, midwives' unions have been saying all of these things for years and haven't been listened to. But they're the people with the most experience representing the views of people working in the healthcare system who really know what's going on. And so I think that unions are really essential to being at the centre of solutions for this.
Yes, that's just another example of like grassroots organising actually being very important for building resilient communities.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
So I guess you already alluded to this a bit earlier, but what are your hopes for the government response that's going to be announced today?
Look, I'm going to be looking out for sick leave provisions. So I'd expect to see something that's a fund that employers can apply to make sure that people can stay on sick leave as long as they need to keep those jobs open for people to return to. I think we also need to look for funds for precarious workers, casual workers and contractors, the self-employed, who are very likely to see a huge dip in business around this time. Mm. Part of that might be the end to sanctions and benefit stand downs that have already been proposed. So I think we need to make sure that everyone who's on the benefit is actually on a livable income and can get through this crisis. One of the things that we've seen overseas in Italy has been suspensions of mortgage payments. I think that's a potential area for the government to look at. Suspension of mortgage payments, but also a suspension on rent payments during the period of crisis. If people are going to be losing their jobs and potentially downgrading from incomes that they're on to the benefit, we really need to look at making sure that people can get through this and be able to stay living where they're living. But also in terms of housing, you know, we've got a lot of homeless people, a lot of people in overcrowded housing, and we need to look at that, because that's going to be a huge factor for people not actually being able to isolate, right?
Yeah, well, how can you stay at home when you don't have a home, right?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, people living in their cars or on the streets or in shelters or even in, as I say, overcrowded housing where there's several families living in the same home, that's where we're going to see huge spread, I think. And that's what I mean when I say that this reveals and exacerbates an underlying crisis in our society, and the government needs to, I think, take the opportunity to not just do short-term measures, but to really make some big changes to the system that we're living in.
And that's interesting, because I was reading an article yesterday about how some counties in the US have done similar things with rent payments. You know, like police aren't allowed to help landlords evict tenants who can't make rent anymore in some counties. And other counties have also suspended arrests for minor offences to avoid overcrowding jails. And the article kind of made this point that these rapid reforms demonstrate not only that governments can act when they're actually willing to, but also that a lot of these rules and laws that are in place are quite arbitrary to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, I think that everything that I've talked about, the underfunded healthcare system, people, the huge amount of homeless people and people living in overcrowded housing, the benefit levels that people can't live on, all of these, none of these things are just natural, right? These are all political decisions that have been made to that mean that people are living in these sorts of situations. And what we see here, obviously, is a pandemic, a crisis that's going to put a lot of pressure on our systems, but it's also an opportunity, now that these are really clear that that this is happening, to make some changes that will last beyond beyond the short to medium term. I think prisons is another, is a really good example of that, where you know, we've got people living already in overcrowded prisons with double bunking and things like that.
Yeah, New Zealand has one of the highest prison populations in the world.
Yeah, yeah. If we're going to be continuing to bring people into prisons from the outside, then it's not going to be long before we see the disease spreading in prisons as well, and that's going to be a nightmarish sort of scenario. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of things that can be done that'll be good, not just for getting us through the pandemic, but also for the future.
Yeah, yeah, and I guess if these like positive reforms were applied because of the pandemic, do you think we would be able to return to what we now see as normal afterwards?
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to predict the future at the moment, I think, and anyone who says that they know what's going to happen in, even in a couple of weeks' time or a couple of months' time, is fooling themselves, I think. But yeah, this is the best chance that I see, is a genuine sort of spending package that focuses on the real problems in the system and finding real solutions to them, is the best chance that we've got to getting back to normal, or perhaps even something better than normal.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
That was Ben Rosamond from Organise Aotearoa talking about a response to the coronavirus that addresses our social needs.
Thanks very much, Hannah. And now we just got a text regarding on COVID-19 outbreak in New Zealand. It says, myself and around 600 other film industry crew just lost our jobs overnight because of COVID-19. No warning. So it is a scary time for contractors in all industries. And let's hopefully the business package that the government will be announcing will cover that. And obviously, after tomorrow on Wednesday, Wire will be reviewing and covering this business package. But now let's go overseas.
Today, we do not know what they want. They do not know themselves what they really want.
I've been wondering what that special place in hell looks like for those who promoted Brexit without even a sketch of a plan how to carry it.
Brexit means Brexit.
To Wire.
Have found their future elected officials. But at the same time that we have medical staff working in emergency wards, dealing with the serious side of this current catastrophe, we also saw people in bars, restaurants, people in the local markets, those people who did not recognize the importance of the measures that had been put in place. They continued as if life had not changed. To those people, I want to say tonight that not only are you not protecting yourselves, and we can have seen over the recent changes that no one is safe from this disease, but you're not protecting other people. Even though you may not have symptoms, you can still transmit the virus onto others. You may have no symptoms whatsoever, but you can infect your family, friends, parents, grandparents, your children, the health of those people that you care for so dearly. We're at war. This is a health war. We're not dealing against another army or another nation, but an invisible enemy. And it is an enemy that is there, and which is why I call for widespread mobilization against that enemy, because we are at war. And anything that the government decides in the coming days and months will be in that sole objective of combating that enemy. After having consulted and listened to experts from the field, and with much thought, I have decided to ramp up the measures to limit travel and limit the contact that people have to the absolute necessary, as of tomorrow, midday, and for at least 15 days thereafter. our movement will have to be absolutely limited. What I mean by this is that any gatherings outdoors, any family or friendly gatherings, are no longer allowed. Going for a walk in the park to catch up with friends or in the street is no longer allowed. You have to limit your contact, any contact you have outside of the home. The government, as of this evening, will give key guidelines on how to do so. And anyone who does not abide by those guidelines will be punished.
That was French President Emmanuel Macron this morning announcing a 15-day national lockdown and new measures for France and the EU, including all taxis and hotels will be put at the disposal of health services. The French army will be mobilised and the external borders of the Schengen zone will be closed for the next 30 days. French Interior Minister Christophe Castaner added some details to the new rules, saying anyone found to be flouting them will be fined €38. And he also added that people will be allowed out to walk their dogs, but not as a group. Meanwhile, in Germany, there have been 5,813 positive COVID-19 cases with 13 deaths. Chancellor Angela Merkel has warned a large number of the population could be infected.
When the virus is out there, the population has no immunity and no therapy exists, then 60 to 70% of the population will be infected, as long as the situation continues to exist. Everything happening now, from hotels to fare operators and restaurants to many other sectors, leaves its mark on the economy, which is why we need a coordinated approach here in Europe, where every member state must make its contribution.
Berlin has announced it will reintroduce border checks with France, Austria, Switzerland, Luxembourg and Denmark, but goods will continue crossing between nations. Italy bears Europe's heaviest burden from the pandemic, with 25,000 confirmed cases and almost 2,000 deaths. Despite a red zone being imposed on northern Italy earlier last month, Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte announced last Monday a national lockdown was put in place. The BBC's Mark Lowen reported from Bologna last Monday.
The virus is outpacing attempts to control it. Bologna was today out of the red zone, no longer. Italy, all of it, is now under the most severe restrictions since the Second World War. Public transport will still run, but the Prime Minister has told people to stay at home except for urgent need.
The right decision is to stay home. Our future is in our hands. We must be responsible.
New measures to limit visiting rights caused riots in prisons today. Several inmates escaped, seven died. A microcosm of the drastic pressure Italy is now under. The virus surging, an economy battered, and now nationwide quarantines. It's a combustible mix.
Spain, Europe's second worst hit area with around 7,800 cases and 292 deaths, also went into a 15-day quarantine last Saturday after Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez's announcement. His wife, Maria Hernandez, has also been confirmed with the coronavirus.
In third lugar, les anuncio que durante la vigencia del estado de alarma,
I would like to announce that during the period of the state of alert, people will only be able to circulate on public roads for the organization of the following activities. Firstly, the acquisition of food, pharmaceutical products and basic necessities. Secondly, visits to health centers, services and establishments. Trips to workplace to carry out your work, professional or business activities.
The BBC's Rich Preston has more on the situation in Madrid.
Public gatherings are banned and most shops and businesses are closed. Cafes and restaurants will only be able to carry out home deliveries. For the next 2 weeks, people have been told to stay at home unless they're going to work or to buy food or medicine. On the streets, cheers of support for health staff, going to work and caring for the sick.
In the UK, while the number of infections is much lower compared to continental Europe, with 1,391 cases and 35 deaths, Prime Minister Boris Johnson still did not implement the same drastic actions as his European counterparts. He said in a press conference last Thursday in Downing Street, while flanked by England's chief medical officer, Professor Chris Whitty, and the government's chief scientific advisor, Sir Patrick Vallance, that anyone with a new continuous cough or high temperature is now advised to self-isolate for 7 days, but did not ban mass gatherings and close schools.
I've got to be clear, we've all got to be clear, this is the worst public health crisis for a generation. Some people compare it to seasonal flu. Alas, that is not right. Owing to the lack of immunity, this disease is more dangerous and it's going to spread further. And I must level with you, level with the British public, many more families are going to lose loved ones before their time. And the chief scientific advisor will set out the best information we have on that in a moment. But as we've said over the last few weeks, we have a clear plan that we are now working through. And we're now getting on to the next phase in that plan, because this is now not just an attempt to contain the disease as far as possible, but to delay its spread and thereby minimise the suffering.
Vallance later told the Today programme on BBC Radio 4 that London is using a quote-unquote herd immunity approach to try to delay infections.
To try and reduce the peak, broaden the peak, not to suppress it completely. Also, because most people, the vast majority of people, get a mild illness, to build up some degree of herd immunity as well, so that more people are immune to this disease and we reduce the transmission. At the same time, we protect those who are most vulnerable from it. Those are the key things we need to do.
Professor Philip Hill of Otago University told me what this herd immunity approach is.
Herd immunity is basically what we call indirect immunity. So it's an immunity that you sort of take from the population level of immunity. So you have to have enough people who have their personal immune protection from the pathogen to not have enough circulation in the community to affect the rest of the people that don't. So it's about having a certain percentage of people, and that differs for different pathogens, who are immune from exposure to either the pathogen or a vaccine to actually protect the rest of the population. So the Diamond Princess had 19% COVID-19 positivity. I'm pretty shocked by that. You do always wonder when you've got the British whether they've got some understanding of something that nobody else has. The best of my knowledge is that they've got this wrong. So you would almost have to deliberately release COVID-19 into the community to get the herd immunity up if you were having that approach. And we know because of the mortality rate, at least in certain age groups, that would be absolutely disastrous. And I'm not suggesting that they were going to release it, but I'm saying it's almost impossible, I believe, to actually establish herd immunity in that way with a natural introduction of a virus.
On Monday afternoon's daily briefing, Boris Johnson's reversed Downing Street's stance on the UK's approach. Channel 4's political editor Gary Gibbon has more.
The Prime Minister, only days after signalling the time was not right to copy other countries and move to a lockdown, said that was what he was now urging on all age groups, those not at most risk and those in greatest danger.
In a few days' time, by this coming weekend, it will be necessary to go further and to ensure that those with the most serious health conditions are largely shielded from contact, from social contact, for around 12 weeks.
And even if you're under 70, again, suffering mild symptoms like a persistent cough or high temperature, the advice has been ratcheted up.
If you or anyone in your household has one of those two symptoms, then you should stay at home for 14 days. That means that if possible, you should not go out even to buy food or essentials other than for exercise, and in that case, at a safe distance from others.
But for all in the country, he said, even those with no symptoms, the way you live should change drastically.
Now is the time for everyone to stop non-essential contact with others and to stop all unnecessary travel. We need people to start working from home where they possibly can. And you should avoid pubs, clubs, theatres and other such social venues.
The advice only last week was that banning mass events would not much help control the spread of the disease. Today that changed.
It remains true, as we've said in the last few weeks, that risks of transmission of the disease at mass gatherings, such as sporting events, are relatively low. But obviously, logically, as we advise against unnecessary social contact of all kinds, it's right that we should extend that advice to mass gatherings as well.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Ko te wire tene maronga irirangi poho. That was International Desk giving a brief review of what's happening in Europe right now. The time is just up to 1 minute to 10 minutes to one, and we will be having another quick break. You're on The Wire.
Hello, wonderful listener. My name is Henry Rollins, advocating for you to take good care of 95 BFM and donate generously and keep independent music and independent programming alive. Why do I speak with such authority on this topic? Because I work at a national public radio station in America, and every 6 months we ask our wonderful listeners for alms, and it is no joke. Great radio is ours to lose. So keep this great musical conversation going and donate generously to 95 BFM. Thank you.
Keep the conversation going with a B-card. Go to 95bfm.com/sign up.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te wire. Marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. And finally, Air New Zealand had said it will reduce its workforce by 30%, which is around 3,750 jobs, after forecasting serious job losses. Serious business losses. It placed itself into a share trading halt yesterday to allow it to assess the operational and financial impacts of global travel restrictions aimed at curbing the spread of COVID-19. Now the company has suspended 85% of its long-haul routes and grounded its Boeing 777 fleet. I spoke with Rachel McIntosh of Etu Union, and I asked about what the union hopes to see from the government's business package, which will be announced later today.
What we are hoping from the government, and hints are that this is what they're going to do, is serious financial support for working people to keep jobs alive, to keep people with an income through this crisis. Air New Zealand is a company that sees itself with a future. It estimates that in a year things will be back to normal. If they take drastic steps now, in cutting their workforce and putting people out of work, it will make that recovery much slower and much harder. So we are challenging them to hold their commitment to good employment, to high skill, high wage jobs with skilled workers who have been dedicated to the company, to pull out all stops to keep as many of those people as possible in work, so our members have decent lives and a future, but also so will the company.
When you say do you expect serious financial help for the airline, is nationalisation of the airline on the cards?
That's not what we're calling for at this stage. I mean, the government already is the major shareholder, so they do have a stake in the airline. And we think it's not just Air New Zealand that's affected here, it's the whole country. And an active government at this time is vital for the response in this country to the pandemic.
Apart from the airline, how does it look for other workers of other industries?
The effects are potentially far-reaching. So we have a lot of people working in the health sector. The danger there is that people could get overloaded, because the health system could be overloaded. But also the health workers deal with a lot of people who are extremely vulnerable, elderly people, people with weakened immune systems. So there's a huge effect there, both health and potentially on the structure of jobs and what's going on. We have members in manufacturing, and manufacturing businesses in this country are struggling to get components imported, so that disrupts their ability to manufacture. We have members working in hospitality. So Sky City, the casino, you know, with no tourists, then there's a huge effect. So really it is far-reaching and wide, but the aviation is just the first hit.
In case that the government business package and the company does nothing for the welfare of the workers, is the union going to take further action on this?
We'll wait and see that. But our philosophy is always stick together, work out what we can do, where we can have influence, to advocate for whatever pain there is to be shared fairly and not unduly falling on the working people.
The French, for instance, love the cock.
You're tuned into The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko ra te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei tī mihi ki a koutou katoa I korero me ki o mō tēnei rā. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. That's all for The Wire today, this Tuesday the 17th of March. Thanks to my producers Bronnie Wilds and Hannah Thompson. And thanks to those who talked to us today. Ka hoki mai mātou a te raiwiki. We will be back next week. Remember to wash those hands and stay safe. The 1-4 is up next with you at BFM. You're listening to 95 BFM and we will see you next week. Ciao.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.